So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink podcast with me, your host, Anna Donaghy. If you've noticed that the drinking culture in the UK is changing and you're curious about why and what this means to your world, then this is the podcast for you. Throughout this series, I will be chatting with the thought-provoking, forward-thinking people at the heart of this shift to find out what makes them tick and to explore the sober curious perspective from all angles. And I'll also be giving you oodles of personal tools and tactics to help you get on board the Big Drink Rethink. So, hello, and today I am very pleased to be joined in the studio by Sue Reed, a certified confidence and self-belief coach, as well as a master practitioner of NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming for those who are unfamiliar, and also hypnotherapy. Sue has an excellent Substack publication called Confidence Matters, and is the author of Building Confidence, How to Thrive as a Shy Person. Sue believes we all deserve a life of joy and success, but a lack of self-belief often holds us back. And we'll also be talking about how it can be the root cause of our relationship with alcohol, and how, once we believe in ourselves, confidence is a skill that can be learned and mastered. So welcome to the podcast, Sue. Have I introduced you fully? Have I done you justice?
You did a really good job of introducing me. Thank you, Anna, and thanks for having me here. It's lovely to be here.
No worries at all. Is there anything you'd like to add? Is there anything I missed?
There's nothing you missed. I would just add that I did have a previous life before I retired in 2019, where I was in retail banking for over 40 years. So it was a little bit of a change for me, but I've always loved meeting people and helping people. So I really love what I'm doing now.
Excellent. Cool. And because these things often have a way of one thing feeding into another, I know your book is very much, you know, picks up on your own relationship with confidence. And is that a thread that comes through from your whole career in the banking sector as well? So,
yeah, definitely. I think my life is kind of in two parts, the sort of not being confident and then being confident, and because I built up over the years. But I was very shy when I was a child, and I had very low self-esteem. And I think the one thing that probably influenced me the most, and it's not her fault, was my younger sister, who was far prettier than me, far more intelligent than me. And then added to that, I had a father who felt that you had to win at everything. You always had to be, you know, top of every class, get your grades, da da da. But that was, I can see now, he was doing that to motivate, particularly me, because, and my brothers, because we weren't as clever as my sister, who like scored high in everything. And I think that pushed me. It's pushed me through my life. And I can look back now and think it actually pushed me in a good way. But years ago, it really affected my self-esteem, because I thought, because my sister is this, that, and the other, I'm not good enough.
Yeah. Goodness. As a coach, I can sit here and I can just hear those internal narratives. Yeah. You know, they're so compelling, aren't they? People often think, and this is really why I wanted to have you onto this podcast, because people often think, you know, that we're having drinks to have fun or to switch off. But when we dig deeper and when we sort of scratch below the surface, confidence and self-belief is so often at the root, you know, this broad feeling of I'm not good enough, of not enoughness, of capability, of worth. And you know, it was something that gnawed away at me for years and years and years. And often through comparison and conditioning. But, you know, I know this conversation is going to speak to so many people because there's hardly a day that goes by in coaching when that sort of quiet voice, or sometimes the loud voice of I'm not enough, is, you know, often what sits below the surface, for sure. So why don't we stay there and just start right there? You know, we often use terms of confidence and self-belief interchangeably, but I do think they're different. How do you define each, Sue, confidence and self-belief?
I mean, there's so many like layers to confidence and elements, and then there's so many selves, like self-belief, self-trust, self-acceptance, da-da-da. There's so many selves to, then they all like feed into one another. But the difference between confidence and self-confidence, for a start, is confidence is how you are seen by the external world. So how you show up. So you can show up to a meeting, a social event, you know, you can step on stage with confidence because you can like step into a confident persona. But that doesn't mean that you are self-confident at all. And it doesn't mean that you believe in yourself. What you feel inside, that's your self-confidence. That's really what you need to improve on. And that's really the thing, you know, that everything feeds into. So I've narrowed it down really to four pillars of self-confidence. And this is what I do with my clients when I coach them, is we look at the four areas of self-love, self-esteem, self-belief, and self-acceptance. And they're very similar, but they all feed into self-confidence. And what I found is if you can build any one of those, it affects your self-confidence in a positive way. So if you can work on all of them, you doesn't necessarily mean all at once, but you could do it all at a time, one at a time, or, you know, a little bit of each one. But the more you build those, the more self-confident you will be. So going back to confidence and self-belief, you can walk into a room, as I say, and be confident, give out this confident aura, and people might look at you and think, oh, they're confident. And we do that all the time with, you know, Hollywood actors, with singers, celebrities. We think they must be so confident. But when you actually get to know them, a lot of them have no confidence at all. And that's why they're in the acting business, because they can put on this other persona.
That is one of those strange paradoxes, isn't it? And I relate to it, not clearly not as a Hollywood anything, but that whole thing when someone goes to you, oh, you're so confident. You're like, no, I was shitting myself. Do you know what I mean? It's like you can sort of, but it's the projection versus the reality, I suppose.
Yeah. But that's only a short-term thing. So you can do that. But as people get to know you and they know the real you, they can see that you're not actually that confident. And that's sometimes when people come across as arrogant, you get to know them because they're always putting on this confident mask. And you get to know the real them and you think, oh, do you know what? They're not confident at all. They're just pretending. And then that can actually turn people off. So this is a good idea to work on your self-confidence rather than just have that. And this is one of the things that alcohol does. It gives you that self, or it gives you the idea that you're confident when you're not. And this is why we lean on it.
So I suppose I'm paraphrasing enormously, and you have all the words, but I'm just going to sort of paraphrase through. But self-belief feels like sort of the strong foundations that we need, and self-confidence is what that can then translate and project itself into. So, but it is possible to sort of almost fake it as well. You can emanate a sort of an air of confidence, but lack the real, you know, self-belief below the surface. What do you see people struggling with most often, Sue? Is it one or the other? Is it confidence? Is it self-belief? Or is it actually one of those more kind of granular pillars that you were talking about?
Yeah, I think the one that most people suffer with is the self-esteem, because this is how you view yourself, your value in the world. And people that don't feel they've got much value for whatever reason, they don't feel like they're good enough. That is the key issue for most people, that they don't feel they're good enough in some shape or form. You know, I'm not clever enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not tall enough. I'm not small enough. I'm not thin enough. I'm not
interesting or sexy or whatever it is enough. And I'm not something.
Yeah, enough. I'm not something enough. And that is most people's main issue. When you dig deep down into the root, that's their main issue. But on top of that, there is that everything else that feeds into it. So that will also mean you don't believe in yourself because you don't think you've got any worth. It'll also mean you don't accept yourself as you are because you think I'm not clever enough, I'm not pretty enough, blah, blah, blah. And they all feed into each other. So this is, it's all heading, you know, into getting your self-confidence up, and then the rest kind of falls into place.
And the other thing that I was going to say, which is just one of these sort of the way our brain is tilted, is we have this confirmation bias where we look for proof points. Our brain loves to believe it's right. We like to believe we're right. We're comfortable there. And therefore, as we, you know, march through life, probably with some of these beliefs born of, you know, our childhood, we kind of go, oh, yeah, there's another proof point. You know, you're not good enough. You're not smart enough. You're not attractive enough. You're not whatever. And we just keep confirming these stories we tell ourselves again. You obviously alluded to it there with your sister. I think siblings, obviously, and parents are a huge part of our backstories, aren't they? Because we don't just form a view of ourselves in isolation. We do it in comparison to other people and expectations people have.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of when you were small, when you were, you know, a toddler, you thought you were wonderful. You thought, you know, and everybody said how wonderful you were, and isn't it clever that you've learned to walk and now you're learning to talk and all that's really brilliant. It's only when we get to about, I don't know, 3, 4, I suppose, that we start taking in all the, well, actually, you're making too much noise. Well, actually, you're clumsy. You've knocked something over again. Oh, you're so naughty. You don't deserve that. And what the child hears is, I don't deserve love. Unless I really behave myself, unless I, you know, play by the rules, I'm not going to be loved. And then you get, you know, parents that divorce. And so one parent goes and the child automatically blames himself, and they think, okay, I've been abandoned now, so I don't deserve any love. And when you get to adulthood, the idea is you take responsibility for your own life, and whatever came before is in the past. But it doesn't work like that, because we've, like you say, we've built these self-beliefs about ourselves, and they become our reality because of that confirmation bias, because our brain keeps looking for reasons, because you've told it that you're not good enough. And so now it says, okay, well, I'll prove that you're right. And so it doesn't know. It's just looking for explanations and proof as to, well, that happened, so therefore you're not good enough. You just lost your job. You're not good enough. And it just carries on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible sort of spiral in a way, isn't it? And, well, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy is what it is. But it's also, you know, again, I've lost count of the number of times that I would coach people who would say, or it would become very apparent that they have challenges expressing their emotions. They're afraid of their emotions. And in a way, alcohol becomes a sort of a numbing. I don't want to deal with that emotion, that uncomfortable emotion. You can trace it right back to this idea that when they were younger, their parents gave them a very sort of clear impression that they were too much, you know, that they were too emotional, that they gave off too much, and they just needed to kind of put a proverbial lid on it, which means that in a way emotions were made bad by that sort of parental conditioning, or not enough, you know, that they felt that they needed, as you say, to sort of strive and do harder, and became incredibly punishing in their expectations of themselves in order to win, you know, to win favor and to win love. I mean, it's awful, really, isn't it, when you think about it? But our needs become secondary when we become that person who needs external validation.
Yeah. And the thing is, when you look for external validation, so particularly if when you were a child you didn't feel loved, which a lot of us grew up not feeling loved, and that's not necessarily our parents' fault, because, I mean, my parents were born in war years, and I can imagine, you know, life was quite difficult for them. And they didn't show me any love. I don't think, I mean, my sister being the prettiest, cleverest, la la la, she will tell you that she didn't feel loved either. It's just the way they were. And also, I don't, looking back, think their marriage was brilliant either. They stayed together for the kids because that's what people did in those days. So I grew up thinking I wasn't loved. And when you grow up like that, you look for love. And so you make mistakes because you get into bad relationships because you were looking in the wrong place. On the one hand, you feel you don't deserve love because you've proven it to yourself that you're not good enough. And on the other hand, you need love. So the people that will give you love when you're spiraling that low, you're giving off this negative energy, are the people that will use you. So that ended up, for me, lots of bad relationships, then a bad marriage. And drink was the way I coped with that. Now, I'm not saying I had a huge problem with drink, but I did drink to numb it, to numb my emotions, because I didn't want to feel what I was feeling. And it was my crutch at the time.
Yeah, well, it's very, very, very easily done. Whenever I end up coaching anyone with regards to alcohol, we always say, you know, maybe drinking has ended up being a problem, but it's not the problem. It's never the problem. There's stuff like that going on underneath, and the numbing of negative emotions and negative thoughts is just right up there every single time. So just really quickly, I'm just thoughts come to my mind as we're talking. Do you work with men and women?
I do, yeah. I mean, my intention was always to work with women because I just thought, well, I'm a woman and women are the ones that suffer with their, and I was wrong in this, that women were the ones that suffer with self-confidence the most. That's not true at all. Men suffer just as much. It's just that they don't show it as much. And again, that's because of social conditioning. You're not supposed to show that you're weak, and low self-esteem is seen as a weakness. So yes, I work with both.
Yeah, you've answered my question, because I was about to say, do you see a difference? You know, and I guess because we were talking about social conditioning, I was going to ask you, do you see this shaping women in relation to their confidence in a particular way? And then, you know, social conditioning and pressures on men shaping their relationship with confidence in another way again? And yes, you said you do.
I found a lot of like men that come from Asian countries, African countries, Middle East, they are brought up to be real men. You know, you don't show your emotions. You don't, you're not weak. You don't cry. You have to be this brave, strong man. And it puts a big toll on them that they don't necessarily turn to drink, but they do struggle with depression because their culture doesn't except drink. They don't get they, that's not the crutch they use,
and it's almost the double whammy. I'm thinking in particular a couple of clients I've had where, you know, maybe that confidence and, you know, just isn't there, but they then also feel they just can't talk to people about it, because that in itself is not a cultural trait, a culturally accepted thing to do. You know, you just get on and do it, and you get all these kind of bullshit things like grow some, or, you know, just plow on and forge on, and it's awful.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day we're all human. It's just that men and women handle things in a different way. Women are more inclined to let their emotions out, whereas men are more inclined to keep everything bottled up, which is probably why men tend to have more heart attacks than women.
Yes, yeah, no, absolutely. So with regards to alcohol, it is often marketed as liquid confidence. You know, you sort of read between the messaging, and sometimes it's a very overt message within the marketing of alcohol. You know, it's the go-to tool for many people when we feel, and I'm going to say socially and emotionally small. So emotionally small in that whole, you know, I'm not enough. I want to sort of, you know, keep myself small, but also when we're feeling a little bit less than from a social perspective, it is marketed as this liquid confidence. Is this again something you see an awful lot of, and what else might you see people turning to if not alcohol, in those situations.
What I find lately, and I hadn't realized this before, but a lot of men turn to porn and use that as a crutch, I suppose, and a way to make them feel better. I haven't dealt with it enough to have an understanding as to why that is. It seems a bit, I don't know, unusual. So it's something I've only just come across. But men are very like tribal driven. They like to be in groups. And I guess some ways it can come out is drinking too much and then getting into fights and letting their anger out that way and getting into trouble. And then, you know, you can have, that can lead to domestic abuse and problems like that.
Yeah. I shall do some research on the porn. I don't mean watch porn. I mean, I'll do some research on the crutch of porn. I'm sure that at the heart of it is, you know, what lies at the heart of most of these sort of activities that don't really serve us, but they make us feel good in the moment, is a sort of...
It's that dopamine hit you're after. I guess gambling as well would be another one.
It'll be the dopamine. It'll be the sort of temporary elevation of feelings, the forgetting of the negative, the more of the positive. It's the escapism again. But I thought it would be just really useful for a moment if I just take a moment to explain what's actually happening when alcohol makes us feel more confident, because there's a couple of things going on. And I think people will get this as well. You know, it's a combination of neurochemistry as well as expectations. So at the end of the day, alcohol is a depressant, not just in the kind of makes you feel sad emotional sense, which it's very capable of doing, but it actually, you know, depresses activity in the prefrontal cortex, which is a part of that brain responsible for judgment and self-regulation. And interestingly, in this context, sort of social inhibition. So you just feel bolder. You just feel a bit wittier or less self-conscious after a drink. And it's not clearly that you've suddenly gained confidence. It's just that part of your brain which worries about how you're going to come across cares less. It just literally... it's dialed down and you care less. So it doesn't actually make you more interesting, more whatever, but you just give less of a damn about how you're coming across, which I think is obviously an interesting, you know, it's not really confidence, it's lack of caring, less caring, I think.
Yes.
And then the other thing is you've got that sort of big psychological association that we expect from drinking as well, that this will loosen me up. You know, I need a drink to loosen up. I'm going to preload before I go out this evening. And that in itself will give you a placebo boost. So we're not just under the influence of alcohol at that point. We're also actually under the influence of our beliefs around what alcohol's going to do.
Yes.
So again, not necessarily real, but, you know, and I guess obviously this can come at a cost. And I wanted to ask you what you consider to be potentially the cost of relying on alcohol for confidence when it becomes our confidence. What are we missing the opportunity to do, or what are we failing to do when we do that?
Yeah, so we're missing the opportunity to grow our confidence for a start, because we're using a false crutch. Something that will give you that short-term dopamine hit to make you feel that, you know, you can conquer the world for 5 minutes, but then you come crashing back down again, and then you've got all the guilt around what you said that you wouldn't normally say, because, you know, you lose the alignment to your values. You don't do what you would normally do if you were in the right frame of mind and not having had a drink. So you miss the opportunity to be able to build your confidence, to let people see the real you, to be accepted as you are, and to be, if you like, the authentic you, and come across as vulnerable. And this is one of the problems that people that drink or have low self-esteem have, is that they don't want people to see the real them. They want to hide it, because they think they're not good enough. But why not just let it out? Why not just see what happens, because you don't need everybody in the world to like you. You don't need to be accepted by everyone.
No.
You only need your, well, the main thing you need is that you like yourself, that you love yourself, because you are the person that you are going to live with all of your life. So yeah. That person needs to love you. So that should be your starting point.
I love that. And I actually, it reminds me, back in the early days of this podcast, I had Laura Bartlett onto the show, and she's, she's a woman that on the screen, on paper, would sort of seem to be oozing confidence, very successful entrepreneur in the sort of hospitality space. And she said, you know, she got to the point in her life where she thought, I don't need other people to, you know, to love me. I have to live with me every day. And the relationship that I have with myself is the most important one. And if I can't sort that out effectively, anything I do is just sort of papering over cracks from an external point of view. And I've subsequently gone on and had lots of conversations with my own daughters who are, you know, they're at a sort of very socially challenging time at school when, you know, they're forming their friendships. And I say to them, you know, you don't have to be liked by everybody. You don't like everybody. You know, you don't love everybody. You know, and I guess what I'm trying to do with them is nip in the bud this sense of dialing down their own integrity or their own authentic feelings and needs to simply garner acceptance, which is exactly what you were just talking about. It's so important.
But here's the thing, right? What people are afraid to be their real selves, to let themselves be seen, because they're afraid that they won't be liked, that they'll be judged. But what you're doing is you're showing you're human. You're saying, look, I'm not perfect. I'm the same as you. You're not perfect either. And people relate to that. They would much rather talk to somebody who gets them, who understands that they're not perfect and you're not perfect. Mm. And people like you more because of that. Yeah. They respect you more. But it's getting over that hurdle, that barrier where you say, you take the mask off and say, hey, this is me. And just see what happens. Just see how people take you.
That's where one of your, you know, your self-acceptance pillar comes in. It's, yes. You know, it's fundamental, because if you don't accept yourself the way that you are, and for all of us, that means flaws and warts and all, then you'll constantly be trying to dress yourself up in, you know, a different set of metaphorical clothes in order to project that image onto the world. And that self-acceptance is fundamental. And that I suppose, you know, such is the true cost of drinking to manage these kind of feelings is, as you say, you know, we call off the search. You kind of go, oh, I've discovered this thing that I can drink probably in your teenage years, and you know, therefore I don't have to build anything more integral or more internal, because I've got this and I can focus my limited energies and stuff on doing other things instead. But of course, you know, you don't go and build, if you've called off the search, you don't build your confidence in ways without alcohol. And therefore, yes, again, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm not confident without alcohol.
Yeah, you're never going to grow. Unless you step out of your comfort zone, you're never going to grow.
Yeah, but I'm sort of jumping around a bit here, but that's just fired another thought in my mind, which is, you know, perhaps a lot of us, myself included, you know, find ourselves putting ourselves in situations where we're generally uncomfortable, and maybe we shouldn't be there. There's nothing wrong in saying, I don't like big gatherings, or I don't like small talk, or I don't like being thrust into the limelight. Well, then be true to yourself and, you know, choose a social life or, you know, a set of activities that doesn't involve that.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, when, like, introverts don't like parties. They don't like big social gatherings because it's draining on their energy. So it's not because necessarily they don't have the confidence, is because of the way they work. And what you can do is you can go to something with the thought in your mind, if I don't like it, if I feel uncomfortable, I'll leave. Nobody's going to lock the door and say, I'm sorry, you're not going. If you need to leave, just say, feel like I need to leave now and be honest. But go, because you might enjoy it. So still go, but just realize that as an introvert, you have to recharge after a certain period of time. That's how introverts work. Extroverts, they recharge by being with people. So a party for them is great. They get lots of energy from it. So there's a difference between the two.
Hugely. Okay, so I suppose we'll possibly come on and talk about that in a minute, but that's also about boundaries, isn't it? That's about recognizing where you can put your own boundaries and make sure that you're not, working against your own interests and stuff. Before we move off the sort of interplay of things like self-esteem and self-awareness and self-belief, I know it's not a self, but can I just ask you how anxiety and confidence are connected as well? Because there's so much anxiety in the world today. And again, you know, there's a real sense, isn't there, that, I mean, my take on it is, you know, anxiety is a sense that something's going to go wrong. And then how confident you are in yourself is bound to have an impact on how you think you're going to be able to cope with it, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah. So with anxiety, you're either worried about something that's going to happen in the future, or something that's happened in the past is affecting how you are feeling. So if you've been to a party in the past and, you know, you've got out of control because of drink and made a fool of yourself, you might be anxious about going to the next one. But often when we're anxious, we're worried about what's going to happen in the future. And we make these predictions about what we think will happen, but that doesn't mean they're going to happen. And if you think something's going to go wrong, why can't you think that something will go right instead? You know, it's exactly the same. There's the same chance of it going wrong as there is it going right. And at this point in time, in the present, you don't know. So if you stay in the present, you don't know what's going to happen. But anxiety comes from fear, and fear is our protection method. So it's our inbuilt protection to say, I don't like what you're doing. This is your brain talking to you, your fear talking to you. I don't like what you're doing. This is scary. Maybe because we've never done it before, or maybe when we did it last time, it went wrong. So therefore, I want you to stop. And then you get these anxious feelings. Once you start to be able to take control of that, the fear dies down, but you need to be able to control that anxiety when it comes up.
As you're talking about it there, I guess I'm coming to the conclusion that both, you know, anxiety and confidence come from this kind of root feeling of a lack of safety in ourselves, you know, safety of the things that can happen around us, and then safety with regards to our own response and our ability to deal with it. I coached a guy probably a couple of years ago, and he said, oh, I have crippling self-confidence socially. I really feel like I need to drink to go to an event. And then he would overdo it. He would drink too quickly just to get him through the door. And of course, if you're drinking sort of fast and hard, at some point, about an hour after he had arrived at an event, it would all catch up and he'd be the most pissed man in the room. And then he would behave in a way that didn't make him feel very proud. And then he would go, you see, I'm rubbish at social events and I always embarrass myself. And of course, that cripples your confidence, because now you're kind of going, who did I upset? Who thought I was being an idiot? Who was ridiculing me, you know, all of the, and it just went on and on and on. And I remember saying to him, mate, the alcohol is a variable here. You know, how much you drink or whether you just try. And in the first instance, reduce your drinking before you go and approach the whole thing with a kind of a real curiosity. I wonder what happens. I wonder how I behave and how I feel. You can always, as you say, you can make a swift exit. You can, you know, you can be in charge of how the evening plays out, but only if you're not, you know, drunk or making silly decisions based on how alcohol has warps your decision-making capabilities, yeah? It's an interesting one. So let's just talk for a moment about how we can start to, you know, to build confidence in ourselves, some practical, you know, if somebody was sat here and said to you, but I just don't feel confident unless I've got a drink in my hand, having that drink in my hand, however fast or slow I drink it, is what gives me confidence in any given situation. What would you advise of them, Sue?
Yeah, I mean, the best advice would be to put the drink down and pick up something else. But obviously, that's not gonna help in the moment. So you need to ask yourself, what would happen if? So what would happen if I had one drink, so one glass of wine, and I just walked around with it in my hand because that would make me feel more comfortable, but I didn't actually drink it. Would that work? What would happen if I only filled my glass up halfway? So I've only got half a glass. How would that? And just like, be very curious. Curious is a great thing. And I like to say to my clients, like, go on a great adventure. Just imagine you're on a great adventure and you've got this experiment on what would happen if I did this? Like, what would happen if I smiled at people instead of trying to avoid eye contact? What would happen if, you know, this drink in your hand, what would happen if you put it down and walked away from it? What would happen to the drink? Would it chase after you? And mm-hmm. would you fall over because you've got nothing to hold on to? Just see what happens. You can always go back and get it. And just try these little experiments and make it fun. Make it, you know, not a crippling exercise. Life is supposed to be fun. But just see what you can do. And is there something else you could hold in your hand that would make you feel more confident? And there's a good exercise that I teach people is, and I don't know whether you know about making anchors. So okay. Say you feel confident if you've got a glass in your hand. So is that because of the alcohol or is it because of the glass? Because sometimes it's just holding that glass that can make you feel mm-hmm. confident. And then of course you end up drinking it. But what if you had a glass of something non-alcoholic? Or what if you had use an anchor? So maybe instead of holding the glass, you put your two fingers, people can't see, but say you put your thumb and your middle finger together and press that. And how you instill that is you think of a time when you were really confident. So there must be some time in your life when you felt really good, something really great was going on. Maybe you were getting married, maybe you had your first baby and you held it in your arms, maybe you won an award. And think of that and just reimagine it, visualize where you were, what was happening, and bring up all those feelings of feeling really good about yourself and really confident in that moment, and press your fingers together, your thumb and your middle finger or whatever fingers you want, press them together while you're thinking that and then let it go. Do that a few times and after a while, you'll be able to press them together and you'll feel that feeling, and you can do that in anxious moments. It's brilliant. It takes a little while to build up. It never actually worked for me, having said that. I never actually managed that. But what I put together in my head was one of the times when I felt most confident, I was wearing a lovely blue dress, a really nice blue dress. I looked fantastic in it. And the sound I love is hearing a bird of prey. That really does something to me. It's like a call of the wild, if you like. Mm-hmm. And so when I feel nervous, I don't often get nervous now, but when I do, I imagine that noise, that sound of the bird, and me looking up wearing my blue dress. And that fills me with confidence.
That's the association,
so
isn't
you can
it?
Have anything as an anchor.
I think that's really important, actually, to point out an element of nervousness is natural. Anxiety is slightly different. You know, obviously you can get into, you know, extreme anxiety and things like that, which is a different sort of thing. But if you're walking into a room of new people, if you're walking into a sort of a networking event, or you're meeting people for the first time, or you're, you know, up on stage or doing whatever it is, it would be really unusual if you weren't nervous. you know, particularly if you're being pushed outside your comfort zone and doing something a little bit alien. So I do think that to have those little techniques to deal with a natural level of nerves is really, really useful. Because otherwise you avoid. And what you're actually avoiding is potentially quite a lot of stuff, because a lot of stuff in life is supposed to engender an element of nervousness, but we don't like it. We just don't like that feeling. And we've become a little bit sort of, you know, we want to run away from the actual feeling. I was leaning into it. And as you say, thinking about those moments when you actually felt really confident, or you felt really good about yourself, is, I love that. The anchors, I love that. I like that a lot. I'm trying to think of what mine would be.
Yeah. And having a mantra or an affirmation is good as well. So one of the things I tell my clients is use the affirmation. Every time I walk through a door, I feel more confident. And so when you're entering a room, just say to yourself, when I walk through this doorway, I'm going to feel more confident. And you're programming your brain. And after a while, because anything you repeat over and over in your head will become a belief, because you've told your brain, this is what I think. And repeated thinking, repeated thoughts become beliefs, and then they become your reality, because you're now feeding something into your brain, and your brain's going to also do that comparison bias and say, okay, right, well, this went right. So yeah, you are confident, and it will keep finding ways now that you're confident rather than ways that you're not worth it. You're not good enough.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So having something else in your hand, like a non-alcoholic drink. Just try it. What's the worst that could happen? You're just like, you know, let's see, playfully see if that makes any difference. So many people, Sue, say to me these days that it's fantastic, obviously, with the world of non-alcoholic drinks being as it is now, that, you know, they're absolutely gobsmacked. It's actually just about holding something, the glass, the ritual. And as long as people, you know, the fact that people don't even know these days that it's not alcoholic is absolutely brilliant. So that's good. The anchoring thing is good. And the other thing that I was once told, which I practice a lot, is if you don't like small talk and you're anxious about what people might want to talk to you about, be the one asking questions.
Yeah.
Don't wait for someone to come up to you and start a conversation you don't want to be involved in. Be the questioner, the one who kicks conversations off that you're happy to have. Not least of all, because confident people who you might be speaking to love to talk about themselves.
Absolutely. So,
you're the one asking questions.
If you hear somebody talking and you say, I'm really interested in that, can you tell me more? They'll love you. Oh my God, you want to listen to me?
Yeah. No, that's, I think that's really, really, really good advice. So the other quick thing that I want, I'm conscious of the time, and the other quick thing I just wanted to really ask you very quickly, self-love, okay, acceptance of who you are. And, you know, again, it's this sort of sense of, okay, well, I know I'm not the most confident person in the world yet. I'm working on it. And in the meantime, I'm just going to be, you know, kind to myself and compassionate to myself. I think often self-love is misunderstood as being kind of all bubble baths and mantras, but in practice, you know, it can be more than that. Learning how to support yourself instead of outsourcing comfort. What do you tend to recommend to your client, Sue, by way of just, you know, how to be kind and have that sort of emotional hygiene of kindness towards yourself?
Yeah, so there's loads of exercises in my toolbox, but one I do really think is a very good starting point is to stand in front of the mirror and look yourself in the eye and say, I love you. And the number of people that find this difficult is unbelievable, but just do it. Just say, I love you to yourself in the mirror. You don't even have to say it out loud if you don't want to. You can think it. And every morning, tell yourself, I love you. And there is a great book called Love Yourself Like Your Life Depends on It. And it's by Kamal Ravikant, Kamel Ravikant. Ravikant.
God, you're not a spelling bee.
and yeah, so in the book, he his business fails and he is on the verge of bankruptcy. He is depressed. He's drinking too much, taking alcohol. Then he takes to his bed and he doesn't want to get up and he just shuts the world out and completely numbs himself. And then one day lying in his bed, he thinks, do I want to carry on like this? This is not a life. And so he walks to his table across the room and he gets a pen and a piece of paper and he writes down, I'm making a commitment to myself that I will love myself from this day forward. And then he got out of bed, he got dressed, he started eating properly, looking after himself. But he said time after time, every minute he was saying to himself in his head, I love you, I love you, I love you. And he said it all the time. And his life improved. And people were good to him. Opportunities came up that he wasn't expecting. Just like his whole, it's like a door opened. His whole life changed within a few weeks. It didn't take years. It took weeks of keep repeating, I love you, I love you, I love you.
Mm. That is something I've not heard that particular book mentioned before. Or that author's approach, but the notion of mantras and the repeated declarations, even if you don't believe it from the moment that you start it, as long as you're consistent and you repeat, again, it's the power of those narratives that they end up seeping in and becoming the truth.
Yeah.
We're going to have to wrap up because of the time, but this has been such an important conversation. I think, you know, I'm not surprised in any way, shape or form that confidence obviously has to start from within. It comes from a place of, you know, feeling safe, which comes from a place of awareness and acceptance. And we haven't even started to talk about that. You have to come back on and talk about boundaries, but, you know, just knowing where your comfort zone is, and being able to sort of playfully sort of start to stretch and step outside it. But I just know from a personal perspective how much my trust in myself, my confidence in myself skyrocketed when I gave up drinking. And I'm not suggesting that people have to quit. They don't. This isn't what this podcast has ever been about. But it is about experimenting whether the very thing you think is helping is in fact holding you back. Yeah. And actually, more trust and more security comes from not using alcohol as a crutch.
Yeah. And asking yourself, what would happen if I didn't drink tonight? Or what would happen if I waited an hour and then had a drink instead of drinking the minute I get home from work, that type of thing.
And ultimately, you know, trusting that whatever life does throw at you, you know, you can deal with it. You can deal with it. Brilliant. So where can people find you? How can they work with you if they want to get in touch? We could put it all in the show notes, but it's always good to sort of voice it at the end of these sessions as well.
Yeah. So you can put my email in the show notes, but the easiest way to find me is to go to Substack, which is substack.com. And then my name is Sue Reed, R-E-I-D. So you'll find me on Substack. And my publication is Confidence Matters. And you can sign up for my newsletter, and that will just give you loads of confidence tips and help. If you want to work with me as a coach on Substack, there is my calendar's on there. So you can book yourself a chat, or you can contact me via email. I'm always available, or even, you know, in Substack, you can get hold of me. I'm always available for a chat.
Amazing. Okay. Sue, thank you ever so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
And
I've really
appreciated this conversation.
Yeah, no, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's thebeliefs, BELIEFS coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.